Hello and welcome to the podcast. My name's Ian Lewins, a consultant paediatrician based in Derby. And I'm very pleased to be joined today again by Dr. Tom Waterfield, who's a paediatrician based in Belfast. Good morning, Tom. How are you?
Good morning. Good, thanks, Ian.
Excellent. And we're discussing a paper that you co-wrote with Dr. Alexander Tracy, which was published in the Archives, Disease in Childhood Education and Practice, on how to use clinical signs in meningitis. Now, I know, sort of speaking to you before, you've got a particular interest in meningococcal disease. How did this paper come about? Why was it something that you were interested in writing?
For me, one of my other roles is I edit the section on interpretations for archives. And we do a lot of work on tests, how to interpret clinical tests, but not very much on actually how to interpret signs. So I can't take all the credit for that, but there's certainly something that myself, Ian, and some of the other guys at Archives have been keen to look at how we actually use clinical signs. And signs of meningism particularly seem to lend themselves to this kind of work. So you have a group of children where you have a pretest probability or a concern. You have a set of signs that you elicit in a set way, and then you can essentially try and work out what the post-test probability is to a certain extent. So I think it fits obviously with my interest and then with my previous work around meningococcal, and then just that kind of interest in what does this sign actually mean for the patient in front of me? How can I use this as a kind of puzzle piece with all the other puzzle pieces to try and put something together?
Okay, so to take it really sort of back to basics, for sort of people listening, what do we mean by the differences between meningitis and meningism?
So it's a really good point. So meningitis is essentially a disease that's characterized by inflammation of the meninges, if you like. So the meningitis itself can be bacterial, viral, fungal, or even aseptic. So the actual cause itself of the meningitis can vary. Meningism is actually the clinical kind of features, if you like, and the signs that suggest that the meninges have been irritated. And some of the symptoms of that are things like headache, photophobia, neck stiffness, as people know about. And then some of the other signs, which we'll probably talk about later on, like nuchal rigidity, Koenig's sign, and Brudzinski's. So essentially, meningism is the clinical features that you're finding, whereas meningitis is the kind of disease process that you're looking for.
Yeah. So I guess my sort of very short reading of this paper is, in a child referred, how useful are the clinical signs that we've all been taught and learnt at medical school and then subsequently slightly forgotten at predicting whether this child does or doesn't have meningitis?
Yeah, what I would say with it is, because I've read it a few times since we're recording on the podcast as well, is it's like anything with these severe infections, it's kind of putting a puzzle together. So no one kind of sign or feature on its own, present or missing, will ever really give you a definite answer. You'll know that in your clinical practice. You'll see children who are slightly tachycardic, but everything else is normal, and actually you can't put it together, and you watch them and you wait, and actually it was just an odd puzzle piece that didn't fit, and the rest of the picture was quite reassuring. It can be the same with these, so you can have signs of meningism that aren't there, and the child can still be quite sick. The child could also maybe come in with a headache or some photophobia or even a bit of a sore neck, but actually it doesn't fit with the rest of their illness, and they don't have meningitis. So we'll go through the signs and their value, but we're looking at them in isolation, and I think it's always a point of saying, well, how does this fit with the rest of the assessment of the child?
So you mentioned those three clinical signs that we were talking about. So there's the neck stiffness, Koenig's sign, and Brudzinski's sign. So for people who are not quite familiar with this, what are they? Talk us through those.
Okay, so thanks, Ian. So I think we chatted kind of before we started the podcast, just saying that actually some of these signs, if I did a straw poll and asked everyone to kind of write down or describe what they think they are, we would probably get a bit of variation between individuals, which we'll come back to. That came out in some of the papers we looked at. So essentially, neck stiffness is that you're finding evidence in nuchal rigidity, and you're trying to passively flex the neck and to see if you can feel a palpable resistance. This is really difficult in young children because you would need an element of distraction to be able to do this. So it's quite hard to try and passively flex a neck and distract a child. So there's always going to be a bit of expertise involved, even in something that sounds as simple as that. In terms of Koenig, so there's some great pictures actually of me with my son.
Right.
Yeah, so he loves the fact that he's in a published paper. He thinks he's a bit of a celebrity now. So that's my son in those pictures. But essentially, so for Koenigs, you lay them supine, you flex their hips to 90 degrees, and the test is positive if they get pain when you passively extend at the knee. So whereas Brzezinski's sign, you position them supine, and you passively flex the neck. The test is positive if doing that causes a kind of reflex flexion of the hip and the knee. So they're probably what people have been doing. I'm sure there's lots of people going around moving legs and moving heads. I think it's good to know exactly how they should be done to remind ourselves, but also it's good to make sure that we're actually looking for it in everyone that comes in that's unwell or has signs of infection, because it can be so difficult to identify those early cases.
Yes, absolutely. And as you say, it'd be interesting if you went to an emergency department and said to everybody, show me Koenigs and Brzezinskis and see how everybody did it probably differently or slightly scratched their heads and went, oh, I wiggle the leg a bit. It's something like that.
Yeah, it caused me a bit of nerves just to actually, it's something you do all the time, but once you're going to commit it to paper or talk on a podcast, you feel like this pressure to get it exactly right. So there are pictures in there. It isn't a tricky thing to do. It's probably something we could do more frequently. All I would say is it's like a lot of these signs, the abdominal exam is a great one. We're very good at distraction to get the true a true sense of what's going on. And I think with neck stiffness, Koenigs, Brzezinski, the distraction is a big part of it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as we sort of spoke briefly beforehand, I think a lot of us do something similar, but not formally a Koenigs. We get some move around the neck and you go, okay, you've clearly not got neck stiffness, but I've not necessarily done a formal Koenigs or Brzezinski's test.
No, and that's fit. So it was part of the paper, and Alex did a lot of this work, which was really neat, essentially looking at the different papers that we could find that looked specifically at these signs. So unlike other testings like biomarkers, where we do kind of good accuracy studies, it's actually quite hard to find studies where we say, how do these signs predict? But there are some out there. And a bit like you're saying, one of the biggest problems was that actually there's probably quite a lot of variation between clinicians and how they're performing tests. I mean, there's also then, just where we're on that, the papers themselves, there was a lot of variation between sites, quite small numbers of patients, and not all of them had kind of confirmed microbiology. Often it was done as quite a pragmatic type study. So, we look at the children that had these signs done and try and work out whether or not they had meningitis from the reference standards available. So, but the table's in there, and it's quite neat. I think it's quite good how he's put that together with all the different kind of predictive values, relative risks that relating to each of the different clinical signs.
Yeah. So was this? So did Alex go off and do kind of a literature review?
Yeah. So we worked together, did a literature review, and then we looked at it. It wasn't possible to do any kind of meta-analysis with it because of the way the data came. So we just literally presented it. So rather than you having to do kind of a literature search and get a feel for what's out there, we've just kind of presented that. So we haven't done any pulled results because we can't with the way the data is, but we can show you what each of the different table papers have put together and then give you some sort of range for them, if that makes sense. So that's what we've been able to do. So unsurprisingly, if you come in unwell and you don't have signs of meningism, it drops your risk, and it probably about roughly kind of halves it or so, whereas if you come in and you have signs that we discussed, so nuchal rigidity, Koenigs, Brzezinski's, it does increase your risk, and that can be, it's quite a big range, but picking the kind of middle value in and around five times your risk. So there is a kind of big difference between being having no signs at all and having one of the signs.
Yeah. And in the paper itself, it really lays it out very nicely, I think, to sort of say, okay, here's scenario one. I've got a febrile child over the age of one, and we'll come back to why that's important. Can the absence of clinical signs of meningism rule out meningitis? And what sort of findings did you guys come across?
So I always enjoy this. So one of the things I really am getting more and more interested in is risk and what risk means to different people, how we perceive risk, kind of how we manage it. So you can, I don't think you can ever, within reason, rule out or something. So say we are this, there is never going to be a child that will have this condition if these criteria are met. So, you know, even with the research we've done, you'll have children that appear well with essentially normal biomarkers or near normal who will have severe infection. So in terms of the first one, can you rule it out? So you have to do a little bit of digging. So you need to know your pretest probability. So what's your risk in the room, you know, before you start? So given the audience you've got falls between probably paediatricians, emergency paediatricians, emergency doctors, and probably primary care. The paper that I always kind of go back to, and it's the paper we used in here, is another paper from archives, which is the Verbakel paper. I've probably pronounced the author wrong, but it's a really neat study that looks at point of care CRP for triage. Yep. Now, I'm not so interested in the point of care CRP, although that's interesting. I'm most interested in their population. So they've got kids, you know, over 5,000 kids coming in with essentially just undifferentiated illness. So it's in a population that have a kind of similar vaccination status, rates of serious infection to what we have in the UK. And so they only had, I think, 17 cases of meningitis. Most of those were viral. So your kind of pretest probability before you come in is actually, you know, pretty low, in and around 0.3%. And I think all this is in the paper. So you're coming in with a very low pretest probability. Now, as we said, if you've got other features, if a child is desperately unwell, or there's lots of features suggest this child's very sick, that pretest probability is going to change. But if you just take undifferentiated illness, walking through the door with no signs of meningism, you're looking in and around 1 in 1,000 risk, perhaps even lower. So you've got because of the way that alters your post-test probability. So in terms of answering your question about rule out, if you're happy with kind of, you know, 1 in 1,000, less than 1 in 1,000, you probably can rule it out, if that makes sense. Yeah. But if you're someone who says, well, actually, I'll never accept any risk at all of anything, then no, you can't rule anything out.
And I think that's a really interesting point, actually, and something that I'm also becoming increasingly interested in. And speaking to my medical students, you know, the children don't come in with a clear label, and it is about managing risk. And all the sort of tests and investigations we do are trying to sort of give you an idea of risk. And equally, when they go, well, why are you doing this and somebody's doing something slightly different, and it is about, you know, your acceptance of risk. What do you accept as an acceptable risk?
Yeah, and then the other part that we never ask are the parents. So that's the other group I would love to work with, you know, find out actually you know, what would be acceptable, but balancing that with the intervention and also the likely outcome. So you know, for something like this is a really good kind of acid test for that. So you've got something that's potentially life-changing, especially if it's bacterial meningitis, but you've also got pretty unpleasant invasive procedures to diagnose it. So especially in older children where you need sedation, you're talking about a lumbar puncture, not pleasant. I'd be fascinating to find out where that kind of risk benefit, you know, harm benefit kind of levels sat with parents, but that's probably something for the future, hopefully.
Absolutely. And then the sort of flip side that the paper talks about is case two, which says in febrile children over the age of one, does the presence of these clinical signs of meningism confirm the diagnosis of meningitis?
Yeah, so that's another really it comes back to the same points around risk. So I think the way it's presented is that, just looking back, so the risk remains under 1%. So this is a little bit how you sell it. So, you know, good news, only 1 in 100 children will have meningitis. So I'm not too worried. Or it could be, you know, terrible news, 1 in 100 children are going to have a life-changing infection potentially. I think if the presence of signs are moving you into that 1%, which on the face of it sounds like a pretty low risk, but again, maybe given the severity of the illness, it's actually probably quite a high risk. And I suspect a lot of clinicians would say, actually, that's a point where I would want to investigate further. I mean, taking the simple statistics out of it, which are pretty... They're informed by they're informed in a sensible way based on the available literature, but are definitely, you know, estimates, and they don't factor in all the other clinical features, which will change those probabilities drastically once you start adding in, you know, do they look well or not, do they have changes in their biomarkers and things like that. It also comes down to just pragmatically, you know, you're not going to say your child is unwell and clinically I think they have signs of meningism, but I'm not going to do anything. Okay. But I think knowing that even if you find some worrying signs, you're actually still looking for something that is now uncommon. So you're treating based on risk still. And that goes back to what we were saying. So less and less are we treating, I think, on, I must treat this bacterial infection, I must not treat this viral infection, I must treat this high risk presentation, I should not treat this low risk presentation. And then we need to have a debate around what's low and high risk based on what the procedures are involved to make the diagnosis and what's the outcome if we miss it.
Yeah. And the final case that we sort of alluded to previously was talking about younger children. And, you know, it sort of says, are clinical signs of meningism useful in children under the age of 1? And why is that sort of relevant?
It's more to do with, there's quite a few different reasons. So first of all, this is written not just for consultant paediatricians. So, you teach medical students and people are uncomfortable with infants, examining them. And we've all seen infants that have had quite maybe subtle signs and had meningitis. So I think it's more subtle. It's much harder to demonstrate some of the signs. And some of the signs, things like Koenig's and Brzezinski's, just aren't there. Signs are slightly different. Some more like to be irritability, you know, an abnormal fontanelle. But it could be as subtle as just poor feeding. And then we've also got to be totally honest, this is a paper that's designed to maybe promote some debate, get you to think about the signs of meningism, meningitis, and give you some information informed on the best available evidence that we've got. But there isn't any evidence really for those children in the same way. So a lot of the studies would exclude the youngest children. I don't think any of them included children over 2 months. So to kind of answer your question, is the signs probably aren't there. The signs that are there are much harder to detect, and we haven't got much in the way of literature to fall back on. So I'd be very, very cautious in your infants, especially the younger infants.
Yeah, and again, it's all about risk. It's all about acceptance of risk, and we recognise that particularly the younger ones are potentially higher risk. And I think everybody's automatically doing that, aren't they? And this is sort of hoping to sort of look at, okay, well, how do we slightly differently manage risk in the older children as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of your risk, you're right. So, again, it's another archives paper, as if I'm trying to sell archives. But the step work that was done out of Spain is a really good, again, reference point if you want an idea of what your pre-test probability is. So even if you're not interested in the step-by-step stuff, going and looking at the fact, you know, they run a kind of 15 to 20% serious infection rate in children under 3 months. You know, it doesn't matter whether they're febrile or not at presentation. And their rates of invasive infection are, you know, you're running in kind of rather than points of a percent, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5%, depending on which paper, which cohort, exactly which group you've looked at. So your pretest probability is much, much higher in those younger infants.
Yeah. So then finally looking at the clinical bottom line, and I am simply reading off the paper now, it says that the absence of Koenig's, Brzezinski's and Uccle rigidity is reassuring in a low-risk setting, but we cannot fully exclude meningitis.
No. I think that's why we're doctors. That's why you're not going to get replaced by, I don't think, Amazon, Alexa or Google, or, you know, you're going to have to look at the population, look at the clinical signs, put that all together, communicate that with the family, think about your, you know, disposal routes, kind of admission, ambulation, you know, follow up at home, GP follow up, you know, all of those things, put them together and come up with a plan that's tailored to the child, which is the fun of pediatrics to a certain extent. Yeah. Certainly more and more for me in terms of actually not just maybe looking at a guideline, but going beyond that and taking the information that's there and trying to communicate that and work to tailor your approach a little bit depending on what's in front of you.
Yeah. And the final bottom line is the flip side of it, of course, which sort of says, you know, the presence of Koenig's, Brzezinski's and Uccle rigidity confers enough risk to justify further investigation, which
I really don't like being too prescriptive because I do think we have to have our autonomy. So again, I think if anyone has signs and they said, you know, actually there was some neck stiffness, or I thought I've got a Koenig's or Brzezinski's positive in a child that's, you know, got a febrile illness that's pretty acutely presented, and I felt it was appropriate to go and investigate that further, I don't think anyone would argue with you. The evidence would support that as a reasonable approach. The signs don't diagnose meningitis anymore, certainly not in the population post-vaccine that we have, but again, I think it does confer enough risk to justify further investigations. I think there's one more point just before, because we all get it, is this is a kind of an opinion piece. So a lot of the way these articles work are they're going to be fun, educational. There's usually something behind them that we want people to learn or to think about. But it doesn't kind of obviously supersede NICE guidelines. So someone might read this and say, but the NICE guidelines say, and that's absolutely fine. And you know, we should look at our local and national guidelines. But this is about thinking about some of the signs and features behind that. And as we progress in our careers, we have to do that and try and communicate some of that with our families and try and start to tailor what we do a little bit.
Yeah. So finally, Tom, having written this paper, has it, do you think, changed your practice at all, or sort of just reinforced what you thought you were already doing?
I think it's made me better, or find it easier to communicate risk. So that's maybe not too many of my decisions are changing, because we do have guidelines that we are encouraged to follow, and they're there for good reason. But I think sometimes you can communicate risks. So it maybe helps me to say, look, you know, there are a few worrying signs here, but although we're going to cover for the worst, you know, the worst case or the more worrying infections, let's wait for the test results and let's see, because there's still a reasonable chance that this will be okay. You know, so I think it's not necessarily had a huge impact on practice, and I'm not sure it will on other people's. I think it'll be useful for reminding them of the clinical signs and give them some context. And that goes back to my points about national guidelines, things like NICE guidance. But it might just help us to frame some of those discussions what we have with, you know, with parents and things like that, and how we communicate what's going on, the risks, and why we're doing some of the tests.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you so much for joining me today, Tom. I really enjoyed reading this paper, and I would encourage anybody listening to go and actually read the paper itself, which is in the Archives of Disease, Education and Practice. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.